Are you looking for your next wine challenge? Do you want to taste more than 300 wines in 4 days? How about joining a community of passionate, qualified Italian wine specialists and gaining one of the most coveted qualifications in the wine world? Apply now to the Vinitaly International Academy and you'll have all this at your fingertips. Pedro Ballesteros, Master of Wine, says, VIA is the only Italian wine program that delivers high-quality training and serious exams. More details on our website. www.vinitalyinternational.com.
Italian Wine Podcast. Cin Cin with Italian Wine People.
Hello, and welcome to the Italian Wine Podcast. My name is Arthur Wooden and my guest today is my dad, Monty Wooden. This is a special broadcast for the third birthday of the Italian Wine Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to the show wherever you get to your podcast. And if you notice that Italian Wine Podcast is not offered on your preferred podcast player, let us know so we can fix it. So, my first question is this. Your real name is Matthew, so why do people call you Monty?
So when I went to went to a state school, a day school, where my dad, David, taught. And after a few years, my parents sent me to a boarding school where you sleep overnight and stay there all the time, basically, called Twyford, which is very close to our house, about a couple of miles away. And we had a history teacher there, a guy called David Barclay, who was an Oxford graduate in English, and he just taught history for us for maybe a year or two. Really nice guy. And he was really into Monty Python. He had, in those days, you didn't have CDs or iPods and things. You had gramophone records. And Monty Python's Flying Circus was a sort of comedy team, sort of alternative, almost surreal kind of comedy group. Very, very funny. And they had some sort of fantastic sketches that I learned virtually all of them off by heart. For example, someone goes into a cheese shop and sort of names every single cheese under the sun, but of course the cheese shop seller doesn't have any cheese at all. It sounds a bit stupid, but if you listen to the sketches, it's very, very funny. When I went to my next school, which was a boarding school called Beedales, which was also not far from our family home, about half an hour's drive away, with boys and girls there, and you could wear your own clothes. You didn't, if you want to wear jeans and stuff, you could. The first prep school was a bit sort of uptight. It was a very nice school, but you had to wear a uniform, and it was chapel twice a day. And anyway, when we get to the second school, Beedales, because my initial is M Walden, the only thing that people knew about me was my first name began with an M, and I liked Monty Python because I could recite all these sketches off by heart and make people laugh. And somebody one day just thought I was called Monty, and they called me Monty, and before I could sort of say, no, actually, my name is Matthew. Monty stuck, and that was it. And so now when I write books and stuff, or do TV or radio, or even this podcast, I call myself Monty, and I'm quite happy about that. Okay, so next question.
How many interviews have you recorded for the Italian Wine Podcast, and who was your favourite interviewee?
We've done about 300, I think, and I don't have a favourite interviewee. As you're probably going to guess, I love chatting to people, and I hope that sort of comes through in the podcast, whether they're wine producers or marketeers or oenologists, whoever. I'm just really curious about people in general. I think that's probably why I became a journalist. I think that's why most people who are journalists become journalists. They're interested in personal stories and sort of what goes on behind the scenes. And having worked in vineyards and wineries and various other places, I kind of feel I have some kind of rapport and empathy with winemakers. It's not easy making wine, particularly at the moment with climate change and things like that. And I've studied history, so I'm sort of fascinated about the history of, you know, why is your label designed like this, or what the family history is, or the history of the land. You know, maybe somebody bought the land from somebody and he or she bought the land from somebody else, or it was inherited. I love all that, because all that, it's just all part of the jigsaw. And I think really to fully understand wine, the more you know about the people, the place, and the story behind the wine, the more enjoyment I think you'll get ultimately. It's not a question of just breaking the wine down into its constituent parts, alcohol, pH, all that sort of stuff. I see sort of wine as a social thing, as a social good almost, in terms of particularly sort of looking after the land, and which is obviously part of community. It's bigger than just the wine is bigger than just the wine, if we can say it like that. And so when you can actually sit down and talk to people and find out their personal stories, you're basically getting paid to have fun and learn, which is not a bad way to earn a living as a freelancer.
So how did you get into Italian wine? Why didn't you specialise in wines from some other countries?
How did I get into Italian wine? Well, long and the short, I'd written a few books on wine, on organic wine, and a publisher who I'd worked with had been asked to do a couple of travel guides, one of which was going to be on Bordeaux and one of which was going to be on Tuscany. And so I did the Bordeaux book for them, because obviously I'd lived there for quite a long time when I was younger, learning about winemaking. And a lady called Hilary Lumsden, who was the publisher, and she said, do you want to do one on Tuscany? And I said, well, I don't really speak a lot of Italian. And she said, well, no, you'll be all right. You just go over there and learn. You know, you speak French, not too difficult. And she convinced me to go. And I had a friend in Tuscany, a guy called Hans Vindingdeers, who's a Danish chap, and I knew his father from Bordeaux. His father was an expert in yeast and I think made some wonderful wines in the Pessac Léognan region of Bordeaux or the Grave. And very underrated wines, I thought. And long and the short, I bumped into him at a tasting in London and he said, what are you up to? I said, I've got to go to Italy quite soon to write this book. He said, why don't you come and stay with us? And I said, what do you mean? You live in France? He said, no, I'm living in Italy. His then partner was Italian. And she owned a Brunello winery. And he said, if you want to come and stay with us, it's a massive chateau, whatever it was, then you feel free. And so I said, okay. And I came to Italy for a little bit, to Siena, studied Italian for a month. I wasn't a particularly good student, as you probably guessed. And I think we had it was a classic kind of Italian thing. There was a couple of bank holidays, so you missed a couple of days there. And then there was a couple of days that the staff were on strike, even though it was a kind of a private school. But it was a great introduction to Italy, and it just prepares you to be prepared for the unexpected. Anyway, and having stayed at Argiano, the lady who did the bookkeeping there was a lady called Silvana Carloni. Have you ever heard of her?
Yeah.
Who's she then?
She's my mum.
She's your mum. Right, well, so a long story short, I met Silvana. And I don't know how many years later it is, 15 or so years later, we're still together, and we've got you. Is our offspring. That's right, yeah. And the irony, of course, is Silvana doesn't drink alcohol. She, when she was small, about, I think it was 5 or 6 or 7 years old, there was some sort of family event, a wedding or a christening or something, and one of her relations gave her a half a glass or a glass of beer, a small plastic glass, and convinced her to drink it. And she was sick as a dog for about, I don't know, 3 or 4 days. So she doesn't drink. She's got a very good palate. When she smells wine, she's very good. She works for a number of wineries locally because she's like an accountant, a super accountant, or what's called a commercialista in Italian. But she audits wineries here to make sure that they're paying the right amount of tax and costing all their income and outgoings and all the rest of it. But she doesn't drink wine, which is kind of good for me at home. And the only thing she'll do sometimes is stick her finger in, and it's the only thing that you do as well, Sophie, isn't it? Stick your finger in the wine and taste. You're quite good at tasting. I always ask Arthur to give me 3 flavours, and he's normally spot on. You're very good at that tasting, darling. Okay, what's the next question then?
How many wines would you say you've tasted in your life?
I have no idea. It's probably thousands, tens of thousands of wines. I don't know. I mean, you can be in a... You know, if you're a judge of I chair a few wine competitions, you during a week you're tasting 500 or 600 wines sometimes. You have to retaste other wines to make sure that the wines that were given medals deserve their medals, or the wines that were thrown out of the competition were deservedly thrown out, or not thrown out, but got no medal, or, you know, not a bronze or a gold or a trophy or anything like that. So, I love tasting, and I take it really seriously. I know my colleagues do as well. There's a hell of a lot of work that goes into making a bottle of wine. And the least I think a wine deserves is a fair shout and a fair amount of time given to it, and even a second chance as well. If you're not quite sure the bottle isn't maybe a great bottle for whatever reason, cork or whatever, you give them a second chance. And I think that's perfectly fair. I think absolutism is never a great thing in whatever industry that you're in. So, I do love tasting wine. I really see it as, I really feel when I do it, I have a massive responsibility to the people that employ me, because Decanter or Vinitaly or whoever it is that I'm tasting for, five star, we have such a responsibility to make sure we get things right. But the most important thing is we've got to be consistent when we taste. It's not fair if we're not consistent. And also be open-minded to other people's opinions, and don't just think that you should live in your own bubble. I think that's really, really important, but especially when you're like a panel chair, as I often am, or a chairman or whatever they call it. But I love doing it. And, you know, someone says, whenever you tell people, what do you do for a living? And you say, a lot of the time I'm either writing about or tasting wine. And you know, there's not a single person that doesn't say, oh, what a lovely job, what a fantastic job. And it's hard work. But yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful way to earn a living. Okay, next question.
How many Italian wines have you tasted?
Oh, I don't know, Arthur. Probably now I taste a bit more Italian than I do other wines, simply because of the work I do with Stevie Kim at Vinity International, with the five-star competition, and also with Decanter, where I'm, what am I called? Regional chair for the Decanter Wine Awards. There you go. But I do, I taste Austrian wines and German wines, and if I'm lucky, California wines and wines from Chile, etc. But yeah, the main focus for me at the moment is Italy.
Okay, tell me this.
Go on then.
Verdicchio or Vermentino?
I haven't really prepared for this one. Obviously, Vermentino sort of a family of varieties with different names, and the other one, Verdicchio, is probably Italy's finest white wine grape. I mean, I suppose you could say Vermentino is kind of grown on one side of Italy and Verdicchio is grown on the other side of Italy. I don't really have favourites. I always say my favourite wine is the last good wine I had with friends. You know, I don't. There's only one grape variety I really don't like, and I know I'm going to get a lot of stick for this, but it's Pinotage. I just don't understand Pinotage. It was a grape crossing created, not in a laboratory, but kind of in that sense. And that's the only grape I really have an issue with. Apart from that, I'll drink anything. Drink anything, taste anything, open-minded, but I do struggle with Pinotage. I'm sure there are some good ones. I haven't found a huge number, maybe one or two. But anyway, listen, did you have South Africa on your holiday list?
I didn't have South Africa.
Yeah, well, that's just as well, because we're never going to get invited there, I'm afraid. Sorry, Pinotage. I will say that South Africa's got, in terms of my organic and biodynamic hat on, are doing some very, very good work on environmentally and at the social level as well, in terms of helping people who have been disadvantaged, and obviously a little bit more work to do, but there are some fantastic projects there. So I'm not at all negative about South Africa. I'm very positive about South Africa. It's just that one particular grape I struggle with. Sorry. Next question.
When you taste wines at a competition, you then write a tasting note. What do you write in those tasting notes?
It depends. If you some competitions will publish your tasting notes, so it's important to write something that's very, very coherent and will make sense to the audience that you know will read it. Or if I'm writing a tasting note for myself, then my tasting note will be slightly different. It will be less explanatorially. I wouldn't have to explain, this is a great example of a Sangiovese because blah, blah, blah. I would just put down, you know, nice fruit, well-handled tannin, whatever. I wouldn't go into too many details, but it would just be an aid memoir for me. I do think writing tasting notes is important, because and you've got to be honest with yourself when you're writing a tasting note. You've got to black out what your people on the table are saying. You've got to have your own opinions and stick to them, but also be flexible.
If you could choose a famous personality to interview on the Italian Wine podcast, who would it be? A singer, an actor, or a politician?
Ooh, famous people. I would probably rather meet a historic figure rather than a sort of celebrity or, I don't know, an actor or whatever, politician. I was born in a house. I wasn't born in a hospital in Winchester. And Chester in signifies a Roman town, Castrum. And the house I was born in was number 38 Stanmore Lane. And at the bottom of the lane, there was a road, as it became. There was the school, the first primary school I went to, called Stanmore Lane School. My dad was a teacher there, so that's your granddad. And anyway, in Dad's sister, my auntie, Auntie Jean, who was a very beautiful lady, a very lovely lady, when she was little, she found a Roman coin in the garden. And it was a silver coin called a denarius. And it was a Roman denarius. It dated from 200 to 202 AD. So that coin had been lying in the garden of 38 Stanmore Lane, where I used to sort of play football and have a little tractor and all those sort of things you have when you were a kid, for 17 centuries. So I'd be very happy to know the person whose pocket that fell out of, not least because maybe that person, having come from Italy, or what is now Italy, had some connection with wine, either drinking it, possibly as a soldier, or as a, I don't know, as a professional, maybe an accountant or something. If he was an accountant, he wasn't very good, because he's dropping money is probably not the thing that you want to do. But I'd like to meet somebody like that. And then the other person I'd love to have spent more time with is my mum's dad, who was a smallholder, and which meant he sort of grew his own food in his very large back garden in Dorset, which is not far from Hampshire. I was born in Hampshire, in Winchester, and Dorset is the sort of neighbouring county in the south coast of England. And he was basically a subsistence farmer. So what he didn't eat or need for himself, he'd either barter, exchange, or he'd sell in the local market. And that's how he stayed economically self-sufficient. And I don't think it's any coincidence that he was a very wiry man, a very strong man, but thin, a man of few words. But he lived into his 90s, and it could just be coincidence, but having that really natural lifestyle of spending most of your days outside in the elements, wind, rain, sun, growing your own food, no air miles, no pesticides, no fertilizers, nothing like that. Very, very natural. Enough to feed yourself and enough to sell at the local market to local people. A little bit of pocket money, pay your bills. And he met my, he was very old when I only met him once. I didn't even speak to him. I don't think he was in his armchair. And he was 40, how old was he? He was 44 when my mum was born. No, he wasn't. He was 66, or in his mum, and her mum, his wife, Amy, was 44. So mum had very, she was an accident. She had very old parents, obviously, at the time. And Amy, who was my grandmother, she worked in service, which meant that she was in a big house in Bournemouth on the coast of England, you know, cleaning the beds and washing stuff and cooking and doing that sort of thing. She came from North Yorkshire, South Yorkshire, and she got away from her family by travelling all the way down south and got that job. And on a Sunday afternoon, she cycled 12 miles on her bike. There's no distance in those days. Because she loved primroses, and she ended up in Verwood, which is where my grandfather was living in a house there. It's now become a bank, unfortunately, got knocked down. Very, very sad. But she was looking for primroses, and she saw this old bloke, because he was quite old by then. She was 44, I think, and he was in her 40s, and he was in his 60s, and said, "Excuse me, do you know where I can find some primroses?" And anyway, he invited her in, because he had some in his garden. And they had a cup of tea, and that was that. And mum was born, I don't know, not that long after, but was a sort of an accident. But again, you know, she had to muck in. I mean, it was a very sort of Spartan existence. And there's no TV. I don't think there was hot water, actually, when she was born. You'd have to heat the water up on on the fireplace, and the bath would have been put, a tin bath would have been put on the living room floor, and you had your bath in that way. And I remember when I was small, I think that happened to me when I was, I don't know how old I was, but quite small. I just kind of like that sort of simplicity, and it's not that simple, of course. I'm sort of not trying to over romanticize it, but working close to the land and eating food that you know has been well grown and healthily grown, and there's no artifice to it, I think has such an impact on your health. And there's no coincidence, I don't think, in terms of public health these days, we're all getting a bit more susceptible to things, and we're eating food that isn't necessarily fully natural. That some fertilizers produced in factories are not the same as composted cow manure in terms of fertility and keeping your vegetables nice and healthy. So my grandfather would be the person I'd like to meet and have spent much more time with, because I'm sure he could have taught me a lot more about gardening and looking after the land and the link between that and health. And hopefully what I do in my writing about sort of biodynamic wine, etc., is trying to convince other people that we are what we eat, and if you put healthy stuff into the soil, then healthy stuff comes out of the soil. Pretty simple. There you go. That's my choice.
Well, that's it from me, Arthur, and my dad, Monty. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Arthur, and thanks to all our listeners that have stuck with us for the past few years. We look forward to the coming year and hope to keep providing content. Now, if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, if you notice that Italian Wine Podcast is not offered on your podcast platform of choice, please let us know so that we can make the connection. Thanks.
Listen to all of our pods on SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, Himalaya FM, and on italianwinepodcast.com. Don't forget to send your tweets to @italwinepodcast.